So you're very welcome to Time Out this week here with me, Stephen Gleeson, and my guest this week is Paralympic cyclist Peter Ryan, who has been a trailblazer really over the last few years in sport in Tipperary. Peter, you're very welcome to Time Out.
Cheers, Stevie. Thanks a million for having me. Looking forward to the chat.
What's it been like for you the last 15 months or so, I suppose, with lockdown? You know, how have you found it all?
Yeah, how have I found it? Definitely like ebbed and flowed, and you know, there's moments where you think it's flying, and like in reality, probably found it slow now from Christmas up to Easter. Now I found that was the worst patch of the whole 15 month block or whatever, but settled into it actually really well. It was that first little like unplugging and actually getting off the hamster wheel for a while and just realizing, you know what, like this wasn't the worst thing to ever happen. Bit of decompress, bit of like, where am I going? What am I doing? And yeah, really enjoyed the first half, but now probably struggled a little bit more with the second half, just fatigue and this, that, and the other. And Christmas, we thought we were heading into a half decent one, and then it turned like chaotic and meltdown, and it was probably as dramatic there early in the new year as it was, you know. I definitely felt like operating the way it was, like you're behaving, you're doing your thing, but like I could have given 12 months not being able to name 10 people that had COVID or 10 people that I knew, and then all of a sudden literally it was everyone. It was just like the walls were closing in there for a while in January. Like there was family members getting that, there was neighbors, there was housemates, it was like it was everywhere. Whether it was the updates, whether it was the numbers, and at the end of the day, whatever it was, like there just wasn't major hope. And we were in this mad limbo of, are we, like, we weren't seeing progress, I suppose, you know. But I think you can see it now, be it with rollouts, be it with just the weather or sport coming back and a bit of optimism. Like, there's a, like, you know, we know when we can go to a swimming pool. We've seen kids going back to GA fields last week. Like, there's just different things that we can look forward to. I can nearly plan something maybe in August, hopefully. Like, so, yeah, I'm in a good place again, thankfully.
You're with someone on the bike, the tandem bike, so it is really tough in a time of COVID to be able to, you know, go around the roads of Tipperary, the roads of Ireland. Like, it's so difficult for a Paralympic cyclist in lockdown in particular. Like, it's just ended your road time.
Yeah, like complete, like, so the start of lockdown again, I suppose, to go back to that, it was fear, there was a lot of unknowns, but like we actually, so say take it back to the start and you're at a 5K, we had a 5K limit, like, so I was generally going out on the road for 4 and 5 hour cycles. I could be doing that up to, you know, 150 to 200K, which hard enough to do in a 5K radius. I may as well have been on a treadmill. But like what people weren't seeing, I suppose, look, okay, there's two people, but there's two lives. And while we trained professionally, much like, I know I was listening to Conor Sweeney's interview as well, and it was kind of ringing true in the sense that like the GA scene, like the intercounty, like it's professional in its endeavor and it's professional in the commitment and professional in all these other ways, but you actually still have to turn around and do a day's work. And I think that's where we were finding complications. Like, there's no way you can socially distance on a tandem, for one. And then, like, I had my family, we were all worried about parents, grandparents, this, that, and the other. Like, sure, like, it was just every complication that everyone had with COVID, it was multiplied by two. And it's like, were the pros outweighing the cons when we didn't have answers? Probably not. So yeah, we definitely struggled to meet up training wise. And even it took 4 months before the Institute of Sport gave us a letter to say that elite athletes could train together and this, that, and the other. So there was time being lost all the time. But yeah, look, it was, like I always say, like, sport is, you know, it's the most important of the least important things, Stevie. And yeah, we figured it out. And we got into a bit of running during the lockdown, and I was training with the housemates a bit more, just in my own little bubble. And yeah, you find ways to get through everything, really. Just maybe it was a good thing I didn't have to do 200K cycles. I should probably say that too.
Great stuff, Peter. Like, just for listeners who don't know you as well as I do, you're legally blind, and like that came about as a young adult. But take us back. We're going to like reflect on it all in this show, but take us back to your early years growing up in Drumban.
Growing up in Drumban, sure. Yeah, like that. You know the crack, Stevie, from John. Great community up Church Drumban, big family of us in, 9 children, living across the road from the soccer field, down the road from the hurling field. Like, tell people that was my life, essentially. That was my existence. Like, I was either learning to be who I am at home or on a sports field, whether it was like soccer, hurling, racquetball, whatever we could play, we were off doing it, or just going through the fields during the summer with the neighbors or whatever. Like, but yeah, it was simple. It was simple is the way I tell people. And you know, we could, like, in Tip, look, everyone knows the crack. Like, you're part of a GAA community, you're part of, that's the village, that's the lifeblood, I suppose, of the place. And that just carried me through life. Like, I was somewhat okay. I was well able to play sport, and you get your confidence and you get your social skills. And on I go to secondary school, playing well, making teams. I was big into soccer. We're like, we played a bit of soccer together back in the day, and I was getting international soccer trials when I was 15. I was playing football for Tip at 17, county minor at 18. And like I say, like, life was good and it was simple. Left school, hadn't done a whole pile. So I went working in construction, and I was serving my time as a plasterer for a while. And then work was drying up there. This is kind of 2008 time I would have left school. So I probably didn't have the most foresight in the world there. I was in the middle of a recession. I said I'd do a trade. But I was doing my trade. I was working at OMC at the time. This is the start of 2010. And then, look, as you well know, maybe some of the listeners don't, but that's when everything really changed. And that's when we started figuring out, right, there's something wrong with my eyes. So, yeah, I suppose 2010 is the time when things changed, I suppose, on a more dramatic sense.
Yeah, and I suppose just to say at this point, I know you nearly all my life, I'd say. I remember playing soccer with you. I remember when you were 11 and 12, even playing football and hurling.
Yeah, that's it. Like, and like I said, the sport brought the whole community together, whether you were from either side of the parish, and everyone knows everyone. And like that, like, I was very much involved, and you're going over to the soccer field from 5, probably a 9, everyone over there. But it was just the parents probably send you out the door and go over there and annoy someone else for a while. But yeah, look, we were definitely like I said, it's a good community and everyone knew everyone. But yeah, a lot of memories around that time, in fairness.
You were playing hurling as well. I remember playing hurling matches with you as well. And you were a very promising hurler, superb soccer player. And I can remember you there, centre mid. And in fairness, you took stopping at times. But life changed dramatically then, Peter.
Yeah, so we were saying 2010, it's funny, now, you do an interview and you always get pointed towards, oh, you were like, whatever, you played county minor or you were on a county minor panel, blah, blah, blah. You will know as well as anyone that's ever interviewed me, like, that wasn't the sport that I was. I was grand, I was a good hurler, I was fine, I was a man marker. That was about the size of it. But soccer is definitely that was my secret passion, definitely. That's the one I had notions of fucking going across the pond or whatever, but different ones that never came to anything, really. I got the international soccer trials, maybe I thought I was better than I was, who knows. But it was definitely the one. I had a lot of flair for the sport, probably not from an area that would have been known for it or anything like that, but definitely I loved it. Like I said, grew up across the road from the field, so that kind of had a lot of influence on me. But left school, working in construction. Back by 17, I had kind of given up hopes of the soccer stuff, and I was just kind of GAA orientated then. I was playing a challenge match and was making a few mistakes that whole pre-season, and I knew something was up, but I didn't have my finger on the pulse. We played, I remember, with the club. It was Paddy's Day 2010. We played the Tip 21s in a challenge match, and I just made one blatantly stupid mistake that I couldn't put my finger on. I just went drawn out the paw for a hand pass. I remember it very well. It was off Paddy Green, and I was in a pocket just waiting for the hand pass, and didn't even touch my hand. The ball just went, nearly half a foot to the side of my hand. And I was just that was weird. It was February or March or whatever. If it had hit my hand and I dropped it, I wouldn't have thought anything of it. It was pre-season. It might have been cold. It might have been any amount of reasons. But when it didn't even hit my hand, I was just there's something up here. I went home and the mother booked an eye test. And as you well know, you've heard me talk about before, but that's when things really changed. So I gave the next, I went for that eye test, and they obviously knew something was up without getting into the whole drama of the story. There was a blur in one eye at that stage. So got wrote an emergency letter to go to Watford A&E. I went down that Saturday night and literally stayed going down there then for probably another 2 to 3 months, getting tested for everything, Stevie, from brain tumors to this, to that, to the other, and ruling out things. Like, that was a mad, scary time, really. And eventually, look, it came back that I had a condition called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. So I'm not expecting the listeners don't have to know nor care about that. But essentially, it's a degenerative eye condition, and it takes 80 to 90% of your vision there over the space of about 9 to 14 months. So that was kind of the road. I was about 3-4 months in. So I had a bit of a road ahead of me then for the next 12 months.
That was a really dark looking road, really, at that stage, because it's into the unknown, and it's hard to find positives, I suppose.
There was none at all, to be perfectly honest. And where do you start with that? Like, the first bit was the ambiguity. So, like, eventually I got my diagnosis, and I got told, right, I basically got told two things, Steve. I got told that I won't ever go fully blind, and that I can't give it to my children. For the listeners or whatever, like, I was 20 years of age. So what do either of those two things mean to you? Do you know what I mean? And it was nice that we got to set the scene here about talking who I was, or the bowled young lad, or the, you know, working in construction, driving a car, fucking playing sports, whatever. Like, I was a typical 20-year-old masculine countryman, for better and worse, all the things that come with that. And now I'm getting told that you won't ever go fully blind. Like, I've never in my life up to that point sat and thought about what percentage of eyesight I have. Do you know what I mean? Like, you either have sight, you need glasses, or you don't, or you're blind. Like, not like they were the only three little things that you ever think of. So to tell me that, and then to tell me that I can't give it to my children. Well, like, you know, I was 20. there wasn't much solace being taken there either, Stevie. So I just left scared and confused and not having a clue what was happening. And I suppose the big lingering question over my head was, where's the finish line? Because I don't know what 90% blind is. I don't know what, you know, what's my central vision, what's my peripheral. Like, I've never thought like this. So it was that, until it got to the finish line, that was actually really scary, because I didn't know how much sight I'm going to lose. Where is it going to stop? Like, I have a lot of, I have whatever, 10% vision now. I have an awful lot of gratitude and awful lot of solace for the bit that I do have. And you see me going around the place, like, the bit that I have saves me. Do you know what I mean? I know people are 95% blind, and I have a lot more independence than they do. But it's not without its challenges, but I appreciate that 10%. That 10% meant nothing to me that day in the doctor's hospital. I was terrified of that 10%. I was terrified in the 90, but the 10% meant nothing. So it was, to say it was even 12 months, it was nearer to 3 years of, like, trying to get my head around it and trying to get the acceptance. And like I said, I said it to you before about, like, that comparison being the thief of joy, and like, I was losing, like, this whole new life was unfolding in front of me, and the reality is, like, I didn't want any of it, and I kept on wanting to just wanted things to be the same as before. And I thought by putting up a front, I thought by pretending things would be okay, I thought by just trying to normalize a very weird situation that I could make it normal. But you can't, like, because I was lying to everyone. And most of all, I was lying to myself, because I was just pretending it's okay. And Asher, it is what it is. And Asher, you know yourself. And big believer in that. Like, it's one thing to lie to other people, but every time I said any of those kind of bullshitty lines, I was lying to myself as well. And that was eating at me, because inside, like, I was terrified. I was confused and frightened. And I was 20, 21 years of age, thought you're going off in one direction, and then life just hits you. And, you know, So it was three years of a lot of chaos, really. Like, and most of the chaos, weirdly, Stevie, was just in my head.
At that time, it was hard for those around you as well, because everyone knew you and, you know, just saw what you were going through. And, you know, there was a sort of mourning almost in a way at that time, but your friends did rally around you.
Yeah, no, look at that. And as you well know, like, and yourself included, like, it was, like, whatever team, whatever, like, I was a part of, like, all those things that I, like, they hurt me to have to, I remember the match where I never came out with any big, like, oh, I'm retiring or doing any speech, and, like, but I remember the game, because even I had got my diagnosis and I was told you have to give up sport or whatever. And I kept the hurling going as long as I could. I played away for another couple of months, like, and I was probably like playing junior at the time or whatever. But I remember just walking into the dressing room. Like I went into the shower, just had a little cry for myself, like, and just knew, because I was getting a little bit dirty. I was getting, like, things were getting away at me that I just couldn't, I couldn't put up that front and pretend I was able to do this anymore. So I had a little cry and just walked away, and I knew I wasn't going back playing GA again. Like, and that hurt me, but it hurt the boys as well. And it hurt. And Joe, I'm not putting myself up on a pedestal here, but you're right. Like, the community really did rally, like, and family didn't know what to do. Friends didn't know what to do, but what they did was they were there. They were always there. Do you know what I mean? And even when I wasn't the best version of myself, and I was probably pushing them away, because like, it hurt me to go to, like I was saying, like Jack and Paul were on the senior hurling team with me, like two brothers of mine. I had first cousins on the team. I had best friends on the team, like that. Like, it really hurt me to actually go to a game. I wasn't able to. I was in this weird place in my head where any game that I should have been playing in, I just wasn't able to bring myself to go. It really hurt me. I wouldn't even go across to the soccer field anymore. And I used to love that place. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was, even whether I had a hurley in my hand or a football, like I kind of started isolating myself and backing away from those things. And lads were trying to bring me places. I didn't want getting lifts in a car because it made me feel like I was 15. And I didn't, like, there were so many things. Like, I was just in a weird place. And like I said, the community was trying their best. Like, but I always say, you can't help someone that doesn't want to be helped, CB. And I probably didn't. I didn't know how to accept the help.
What did you do then?
Eventually, like, it just all came to a head. I had to. Like, I was fit to explode. I said, like, you can't help someone. So, like, I ended up, like, as you know as well, like, you know, I suppose I'm talking for the benefit of the listeners here as much as ourselves here, but like, yeah, like, I went down a drinking road, and like that, I was trying to normalize it, because one, I was always at a party, so you can't be sad if you're at a party. And you know, it wasn't like brown paper bag under a bridge or any of that kind of drinking. Like, I was just became a socialite, and I went and I thrown myself. I lived the college life. I went to every campus in the country. I went to every 21st. I went, it was all party, party, party. I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy. But like I said, I was always, like, I was lying to other people, but I was lying to myself. And eventually, look, that it came to a head, and we spoke about the family and friends and that. And like, there was just kind of one of those lovely intervention moments. Like, I had my sister call up to the house that I was renting at the time. And it was just a case of, look, I don't know what's going on, but like, you need to talk to someone, you need a bit of help. And look, it eventually, I did. I suppose this is a very much a Tipperary based conversation, but like, I went to Asheree and Care, and like, without a doubt at the time, like, that was the best decision I ever made, because like, it take away the drink, like, because look at, I was, and I still don't have all the answers on that. Like, was I a 22-year-old with a drink problem, or was I a 22-year-old with a life problem who was drinking very heavily, like, because of it? I don't know, but I do know going in there forced me to stop and think and look at it and to talk about it and to play out some of the fears that were in my head and some of the, because I didn't know what it was to be visually impaired. I didn't know how to be blind. I didn't know what that meant for me. Do you know what I mean? Like, we deal in stereotypes. I was like, can you even have a job if you're blind? Can you, do you know, my mates were kind of traveling the world at that stage. There's people going to Australia, they're going to America, they're going here and there. Like, I was afraid to get trained to Houston. Like, I, do you know what I mean? That's kind of where how rudderless my, you know, my life was, or how hopeless I thought it was, or can you have a girlfriend if you're blind? Can you have a wife? Can you have a, do you know what I mean? All these fear, like, as I always laugh, I tell people, like, my fears, like, the things that were getting me down started off with real practical things. It was things that I couldn't do. Like, so if I put my nose to the mirror, I can't see my face, right? So there's one thing that makes you sad. It's like, if I look down at my feet, I can't see my feet, right? So it starts off with actually things that you can't see. I can't see the match on the telly. I can't see the this. I can't see the that. But the thing I tell people to kind of, like, because I do talks, I went to schools and blah, blah, and I just tell people to watch out for when you're projecting. So while it started off with those literal things, then I started telling myself, oh, sure, you can't have a girlfriend because you can't drive a car, or you won't ever be able to have those children because you won't be able to click them for school. Like just random things, like, but you start telling yourself the things that you can't do, or you can't travel because you're like, you can't get on a plane because you're not independent enough to negate an airport, and you can't do that. Like, and I just started telling myself all the things that you can't do. And that got to a place where it was just on top of me, all the things that you can't do. And eventually then you're doing nothing, only sitting on your hands at home and really, really and truly just watching the world pass you by. So yeah, going to that place in Care, going to Asheree, that was, like, at the time, the best decision I ever made, because it was just 28 days to decompress and 28 days of counselling and to talk about the problem. And yeah, like I said, very happy sitting to you here today that I actually did it.
It's fascinating listening to you, Peter. With three songs in this show, music is something, I suppose, that gets people through tough times too. Have you a song choice?
Yeah, I'll start off, I suppose, just based on that little phase of conversation that we have. There was no particular order. I have three of them in mind, but I think we'll start off with Pearl Jam, Yellow Ledbetter. So it's a cool song, but the listeners will be listening to it. You can hardly hear the lyrics in it. He's so mumbly throughout it, but essentially it's about, like, is he the boxer or the bag? And I think it kind of encapsulates a lot of, like, One of the not so positive effects of losing your eyesight is you do a lot of thinking. You're living in your head. And yeah, I think the lyrics of this song kind of really, they spoke to me kind of through a different phase of my life where sometimes you're winning and sometimes you're losing. But I think I'm always asking that question, which one am I at this given time? But yeah.
So you're welcome back to Time Out here. Peter Ryan is my guest this week. You heard Pearl Jam there. Peter, it's tough for me doing this interview because I know you so well, and it's tough for you the same because you often meet people that you're doing interviews with who don't know the details of your life and that. But I kind of saw you live through that phase. When did you come out of it then? Like, how long before you actually started to feel a bit better?
Yeah, I think that's... going to Care, going actually dealing with it, actually making those first practical steps. Like there was never a eureka moment. Like, do you know what I mean? I do a bit of talking now in companies, as I was saying, like, and you go in, you're working in this wellness space, and it's like, well, what is it, Stevie? Like, do you know what I mean? It's not me on a pedestal telling people, or what you see on Instagram and people projecting, this is how you do it. Like, for me, like, your happiness can fluctuate, that can be up and down, like, but for the most part things are good since I started trying to get a bit of control in my life. And but I've had a couple of ups and downs since, like, or I've had a couple of downs since or whatever, but like, but that 2013, like, that was the start of actually turning the narrative on the visually impaired piece and the legally blind and the fear. And I always kind of put it down to, like, we're talking about the stories we tell ourselves. And the big thing with me was, like, I had all these things of what it meant to be blind or what it meant to be visually impaired, but I never actually challenged any of them. And I kind of call it self-limiting beliefs, call it whatever, like, but I didn't challenge, like, those things that, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do that. They were just, like, concrete certain facts, even though I never tried. So yeah, I got the emotional piece. I had done the counseling, but, like, I also, there's a practical piece to that. I had to start living a different way. I had to start trying. I had to start just throwing myself into scenarios and just realizing, like, essentially, like, I was 22 and it's not terminal and life has to go on. And I want to smile. Do you know what I mean? I want to have a bit of a life again. So I did. I just started, not putting up those fronts anymore, talking about, like, I kept counseling on for probably another 2 years after that. And that's something that probably not everyone would know, but like, I just kept it going, kept talking to people, kept talking about it and trying to work on myself. Cause I had this whole, I suppose if I was to take a positive out of this whole thing, like visually impaired Peter Ryan didn't exist. So I was kind of getting to creating myself, and that's kind of the mission that I went on. Then I was like, well, what can I do? What can I learn? How will I do this? How will I do that? And like, and that was just the buzz that took me on for the next few years. Like I started trying to figure out new things. Like I had to retrain how to use a laptop. I had to retrain how to use the mobile. I had to, you know, like all these simple domesticated things that people take for granted. Like what way do you pour a cup of tea? Like everything changed for me. It wasn't just the not playing, you know, with a tip jersey or the not playing with an upshirt thing. It was like, it was from the major things to the simple, you know, like I said, the way I look at it. So yeah, I just started challenging things. I like, obviously, like I said, sport was a huge part of the old me. I wanted to use that in the new version, and I went up to a Paralympic Open day, and that was obviously the start of that journey. I just wanted to get back into sport. Like there was no grand plan. It wasn't about getting into cycling. It was about I had so much hang-ups about the word disability or about visually impaired, legally blind. Like I thought I couldn't ever play sport again. I thought I was gone forever. And then the counselor was telling me, you know, like I actually had moved on to talking to a visually impaired one at this stage. And she was like, why not the Paralympic stuff? Like, why not get in and see what that's about? And so I went up to that open day, and like
you
said,
wanted to stay in sport, didn't you? You really wanted to stay some part of sport, what you could.
Yeah, well, it hit me hard, like when I had to give it up. And I didn't realize how much what I had until it was gone. And I know that's all very cliched, but it's the truth, like, of the matter. I never acted as someone that this could go at any time. Do you know what I mean? You growing down to the hurling field since you're five, soccer field the same way, like you're just seeing the boys playing up to 36, 37, you know. You assume that's your sporting career, like, and I never thought for one second that this could be gone, be it through an injury, be it through anything. I just assumed.
So you started in cycling then?
Yeah, I went to that open day, and they, like I say, I wanted to use sport to start piecing things together. Like, there was a load of different sports. I actually tried judo for a while, would you believe, as well, but the training was too far away and I had to get a lift, and that just fed into the problem. So I got on the bike, and look, at cycling was growing all around the country at the time. Things were good, and I just hit the ground running. Like I won a national title. Like I was only cycling 7 months when I won my first national title. So that kind of just thrown me into a space that I probably wasn't even ready for. But I had the Irish coach then contacting me saying, would I be interested in coming in on the squad? And they were talking about Rio, and they were talking about this, and they were talking about that. And it was just all like bright lights. And I just kind of got swept up in it, and there was no grand plan, but I was feeling good again. And I was smiling, and I was back doing a bit of training, and I just rolled with it. I was like, do you know what I mean? There was enough unhappy days there for a while. So why not just, when things are happening for you, just see where they go. And that's kind of what I did. And like I said, I got that appreciation back, and I was like, do you know what? If I'm getting sport back, I'm jumping in two-footed. And I was actually, in every way, I was probably a better athlete the second time round than I ever was before I had the sight issues. So it was a funny transition to make. Not without its challenges, but yeah, it was just one of those cool decisions. And then I just went on a journey for the next 4 years with cycling that ended up in Rio. So happy days.
Wow. So you ended up at the Olympics in Rio, but how did you go about it? So you needed somebody on the bike with you to be in front who could see the road, and then you were behind doing the pedaling.
Yeah, like that. Sure. I knew very little. Like I knew nothing about tandem cycling until I got on the tandem. But anyway, so once I got called into the Irish squad, at least finding the pilot was looked after by the Irish squad. So the pilots had to go on a trial. So that's the guy in the front of the tandem. Now they were elite athletes in their own right. Like the reality is, like, they get a medal, like say in my sport, they get a medal at the Olympics as well. It's one of the only, it's a rare combination. It's a rare sport, like, where, you know, without them, they're helping me fulfill dreams. They're helping me, they're giving me independence, empowerment, but they're racing the bike as well. Like, so it's, yeah, they are the eyes, and I go so far as to say they're half the brains on the bike as well, because like, I suppose split second decisions have to be made in a bike race, and like, they're at the front. So it's my job to be intuitive enough to know what he's doing. And I suppose over time we build a rapport and we build a relationship that we know how each other act in different scenarios. But yet there was such, like, I started off knowing nothing about cycling, and then furthermore knowing nothing about tandem racing. And so like, I had to become, I suppose in my own way, like, I had to study the sport, I had to learn about it, I had to drive my own agenda, because I had come from being a team athlete and then becoming a solo one. It's a completely different mindset. That was actually one of the biggest things I struggled with, actually, like going from team sports to an individual sport like cycling. Very hard transition to make.
Yeah, so it's 100%, I suppose, when you're a cyclist, everything you do matters. Whereas when you're in a team, okay, you're meant to be still alert when the ball is the other end of the field, but subconsciously or some way you switch off a little, but you can't ever really switch off when you're on the bike, because every choice you make matters.
Yeah, and it's not even just on. So yeah, quickly on the game, like, there's like, look at, I've played, like, I've had borderline man of the match type performances and lost in a GA context or in a soccer context, but at the same time I've played rancidly and the team won. It's like, that will never happen to you on a bike. Like, if I play well, I give myself a chance of doing well, and if I play bad, well, I'm going to be kicked out the back after about 10k and I'm chasing the race for another 150. But like, it's a really honest endeavor that way. Like, and weirdly, like, there's no one on my team that can fucking, you know, pull it out of the fire when things are going bad. Like, it's up to you and your teammate, and that's it. Like, so there's something real honest about that. And then the only place you get that confidence from then is knowing that you did all the training, you turned up every day. Like, you have to be on that start line almost, just like, that's where you get the confidence. It's like, you're on the start line saying, yeah, I did everything I could to get me as well prepared for this start line as possible. And you're almost like looking around at the lads, and you're making up the narrative. It's a weird one. Like, you're saying, like, you know, they didn't do half the things that we did. And look, they might have done every bit of the things that you did, but you have to pull that out of somewhere and feel like you deserve this. And, you know, so it's definitely different to the team element stuff.
And Peter, just for those who, you know, mightn't have seen a race, what time of the day would you start at? What time would you finish? How many kilometers would you go? What speed would you be doing?
Yeah. So I'm really lucky. Like, obviously involved in the paracycling, I got to do track and road. So I got to have two seasons in 1 year. I do the track season from like January to March, which is the velodrome. The people can picture it, I suppose, round and round on the timber. But on that, I would have specialized in kind of speed endurance stuff. So I would have done the 4K pursuit. So 4 kilometers, my PB at that was 4:16. So like, yeah, like you're averaging 60 kilometers an hour there. Well, it's like 58 or 59-ish kilometers an hour. So fairly tipping at that one. And then the road race season. So our road races will be typically about 120K. And on that, depending on the terrain, we could average generally between 44 and 48 kilometers an hour for depending on how hilly or how flat it was. Like, so it's fairly full on stuff. Like, yeah, but again, very good buzz. And for like, and like I say, it's not just like, it's a very small scene over here in Ireland, but like, I was wearing an Irish jersey. So I was traveling the world doing this. Like, I was going to Canada, South Africa, all around Europe. Like, it's just, when I look back, like, it was just this phenomenal experience I was on, like, where you're just, and even being involved in Paralympic sport in general, not to mind tandem, not to mind cycling, like, you're just meeting all these cool people with, everyone has a unique story. Stevie, like, for anyone you meet in this world that has a disability, everyone has a story, but like, you meet these people that are just so open about what happened or how they got through it. And it's like, it gave me a very different outlook on life, actually, meeting Paralympic athletes, because it's kind of the one thing I'm certain of, like, everyone has a story, and problems are relative. it might have taken me 3 years to get over my one, it might take someone else one, it might take someone else 12. It doesn't really matter. It's just about getting to the other side of things.
Wow, you've just an amazing attitude. Going to Rio, being part of the Olympics, I know being from Upper Church that I met a huge amount of the people locally and they were so proud of your achievements. I remember when Michael Ryan and James Barry came back with the Lee McCarthy, you were spoke of on the stage with, you know, great love and affection by James Barry and Michael Ryan, and you were getting ready. Rio was a huge thing, the first Olympian in Upper Church and representing Tipperary and Ireland as well. What was it like?
Yeah, like the games themselves, look, they were like, that's just something that's with me for the rest of my life. Like the Olympic Village, I could do this whole interview talking about the Olympic Village. Like it's because it's a town. It's like it's 4,500 people, give or take, in the village from 168 different countries. And like I said, you throw in the disability factor, you throw in the, like some athletes are coming from a country, right? It's like there's Ukrainians, they're coming from a civil war situation. There's other people. Like it's like you get a better sense of what it means to have a disability in different countries. It was like traveling the world, essentially, going to this one place, because you're just going down to the canteen and you're sitting beside the Chinese team and you could be having a chat with someone there. And then you're, you know, you're in Uruguay tomorrow and it's mental, like so. And I love meeting people and having these kind of conversations and what's going on. And then obviously there is the pressure of the event. But like in some ways, like the pressure was gone. Like the pressure was trying to get there. The pressure was, you know, and like I said, I have this outlook where it's like, that's not pressure. Like this is a pure privilege. Like this is, you know, like you just, you're waking up every morning. Like I had a smile on my face every day and I would get a bit nervous before certain events, like, but like at the games, I actually didn't have any of that. I was like, this is just like, it might never happen again. Just take it all in. Leave it all out there when it comes to the racing side of it. But it was funny, like I always say, like I went from like that treatment center in Care to the Olympic Village in 4 years. It was like there were two very different treatment centers, but but like they both shaped me in different ways as well. Like, and yeah, it was just like you say, it was, but it's 3.5 years of slogging to get there, and I was very aware of that as well, and I was lucky I got there by the skin of my teeth in the end. And it was just like, you know, just appreciate every bit of it.
And the pilot, you must have had a great friendship with the pilot as well.
It's everything. So Sean, like we actually got separated right before Rio, which was complicated enough. I ended up going with a different guy, but it was very weird. But the whole dynamic on a tandem, it's all about that partnership, because Sean Hassey down in Carrick, yeah, so he would have been my long-term relationship would have been with Sean. But I can't explain it very well. Like, so the only sport I can nearly akin to is like the two rowers, like you have the Joe Donovan brothers, like doing it together in the boat or whatever. But like I always say to people, like Paul can get out and win the world championships on his solo canoe. Joe, that wasn't an option for me. Like if I'm not on a tandem, I'm not on a bike. So like you build this real strong friendship with the guy you're racing with. And to be honest, like you say, representing parish, representing county, country, all those things kind of go out the window. Your world becomes small. It's just about the two of you and you're trying to do it for each other. And I'm not going to give up because I don't want to let him down, and you're hoping, do you know what I mean? And you know you have enough yardage on you. You become like family, like you're. So I always say, like, we go away in a training camp. So you're training for 2 weeks. You could be on the bike 5 hours a day for 2 weeks straight. And like, right, so that's me and him side by side for 5 hours of that day. Then because I'm visually impaired, I'm going around basically, you could be linking his arm, going around Mallorca for the rest of the day. You're sharing a hotel room that night. Like, you're just clocking up minutes and hours with this person that if you didn't get on well with him, it would show on the bike. That's the one thing, like, you have to get on as people. And thankfully, like with the Sean dynamic, like two of us were like brothers. Like it was just the most fun, and it was brilliant. And we fought hard for each other. And yeah, it's and then the nuances of the sport, I actually couldn't even begin to talk about how you communicate without talking on a tandem and all it, and the trust. Like we, that course in Rio, like you had the famous hill in it. Like we, like sadly, like actually someone died on the hill in the race before my one. They felt like, look, anyways, we won't go into that there now, but like, But when you talk about trust, like, we were hitting 112 kilometers an hour every time we went on that hill. We had to do it 12 times. Like, there's a lot of stuff goes through your head at 112 kilometers an hour on a bicycle. but ultimately it's about trust. And yeah, there's a lot of dynamics that play on a tandem. Yeah.
Wow, that's unbelievable. Well, we just have an hour here. So I'm looking for a second song choice, Peter, from you.
Right, second song choice. As we were talking about, I suppose, GA world there earlier on, just something I always go back to when you're talking about, like, that phase of my life there, kind of from maybe 18 to 17 to 20, or playing senior hurling or playing with the two brothers and playing with Upchurch in general. But I always, like, for me, when the music stuff, like, see, I don't know, like, I'm into my music, but I love how, like, a song can just teleport you to a place or a time. But I can't hear AC/DC without feeling like I'm in my brother's car on the way to a match. And, like, we used to be very different personalities when it came to getting ready for matches or whatever. I'd have been a bit more laid back, but Jack was on edge from 10 o'clock that morning. You couldn't talk to him. But anyway, so AC/DC always kind of reminds me of that phase of my life. So we'll go with You Shook Me All Night Long.
That was AC/DC there, the second choice of Peter Ryan. Going down the hill in Rio, as you described there before the last song. I mean, that is just something else, to be the other side of the world and going down a hill that at that pace with the journey you've been on. Like, do you find when you're cycling, loads goes through your head or loads leaves your head? Or
when you're in it, and it's almost, it's just flow. Like, John, there's not a crazy amount of... Right, Rio, it's a cool example. You hit the 112, and that's probably the fastest I've ever done on a bike. But, like, there's loads of occasions where I've done 100 or 90 and this, that, and the other. And there's something, you do have that for a second, you think, right, if something bad happens. But, like, honestly, you can't stay there. Like, you're in it, because same with hurling, same with half going into any tackle, whatever. Like, it's when you're thinking like that, something bad will happen. So you just have to... Like, more often than not, you're not thinking at all. You're just going with the flow of the road and doing what feels right and trusting your pilot. But yeah, like, like you say, we're in a tropical. Sometimes the best moments you'll have in these places, like, because you go, like, you're professional. You're either in a hotel room or you're there to race. But, like, what we're lucky with is, like, we have to train on the road. So, like, the day before or 2 days beforehand, if we're doing a bit of training, like, I love, like, doing a bit of, like, going, using the bike to see maybe the city or to see a bit of where we are, like, and, like, Rio, you know, like that. I've been to Japan, I've been to South Africa, like, I've been to these amazing places, like, and because, like, I always think if I was a swimmer, I wouldn't have half the stories to tell, because you'd be just going from hotel to a pool, but the bike gives you a cool sense of the country, it gives you a cool sense of even just the climate, whatever it is, but you're at least you're out in the elements a touch, and you're kind of, you get to salute people or you get to go to a coffee shop or whatever. But it's just been amazing experience in general. Yeah.
So you went to Rio, huge homecoming in Tipperary, and like you got into another event, was it a year or two ago, where you went all around Ireland? That was just a phenomenal challenge and just something really unusual, where you were going without sleep and you were going up and down from Kerry to Donegal, was it? Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so we did an event called Race Around Ireland. So it's kind of exactly what it says in the tin. We did, we're starting in Navan, but hit the coast and then go the whole way around. So we did 2,250 kilometers in 122 hours, became the first tandem to ever finish the race. There's time markers that you had to hit in different checkpoints, and if you're not there by a certain time, you get kicked out of the race kind of thing. So we had to follow a schedule. Like it was mad intense. Like it was, like I said, we did it in 122 hours. We only slept for 8 hours in 5 days, like in total. So you're just operating on little naps. Like we were doing, you know, the bones of 450K a day, just cycling through the night all around the country. I say we, I really do mean we, because it was me and Sean on the bike, but we had the support team, we had a camper van, we had a van and a care. I had some of my best friends, family, people just going around all week supporting us. It just turned into this crazy experience. And it started off so innocently. That was the mental thing about, like, it started off myself and Sean like that. We were cycling. This is 2018. So I probably had 5 years done on the bike, kind of four years of kind of training professionally. And you're going to your races and you're more like a military man, turn up to the events, do the race, go home, this, that, and the other. We kind of just said we'd do it. We said at the start of the year, we'd do it as a team bonding type thing, because the World Championships were coming early that year. They were going to be on in August, and usually they're on not until early October. We just thought, yeah, sure, we'll do it. And kind of little did we know, like, what we had signed up for. Like, so I met the race organizer that April, and he kind of actually terrified me. So I actually realized what we were doing after talking to him. He's a sports psychologist, and he was just saying, like, no, you've no idea. Like, he's like, look, to put it quickly, it's never been finished by a tandem. So yeah, you might be elite, but this is not about being a strong cyclist. It's about mental fortitude. It's about, like you said, being able to cycle a bike when you're sleep deprived, when you've only got a fifth, like when you're doing, when you're 1400 kilometers into a race and you're not even halfway. It's like, that's like, so yeah, I suppose after that conversation, I decided then we'd do it for a good cause. And so it kind of changed the whole rationale behind it, and we decided to try and raise some funds for two local families. And as you well know, and I'm sure listeners, a lot of them might have heard of it, but yeah, like we did a really good thing, and that's probably as important as the war stories that we have.
It's amazing. And we just have the hour here, but to cut a long story short, you became a politician, then went for the elections and got in another, you know, new chapter, I suppose, in your life.
Yeah, Stevie, my world is never simple, really, is it? I suppose the opportunity came to me, and I was very much in the headspace of retiring after Tokyo. Like, who am I? What am I? Like, you know, because I I'd left and I just went off cycling a bike, and before I knew it, the bike had become my job, and I was doing a bit of talk and stuff, but I wasn't doing it, like, I wasn't building a future. I was just enjoying the here and now. That offer came to me, and like I said, I had been involved, be it with fundraisers, be it with community projects, different things. Like, I was like, do you know what, like, I'm getting into it here with good intentions, like, what, you know. But again, like, that's so different, like, even just becoming elected. Like, it wasn't just one day I was elected. Like, it was a complete slog. But like, campaigns, like, are hard. They are tough, and it's door to door, and it's meeting people, and you can't avoid getting elected any other way. It's roll up your sleeves and canvass until you can come in. And like, you're just, I would give a month of just falling into the bed, waking. I was trying to keep my training going at the same time, so I was getting up, like, I was on the bike at 5 during that whole phase, like, because I needed to get training done, because I wasn't able to train when I got home in the evenings. It was too late. And anyways, look, got elected, whole new phase of my life. And honestly, since then, I've been just learning and learning and learning, because it is the most diverse job you can ever have in your life. And I can assure you that, like, it's, you know, it's not any one thing. Like, politics is something different to every phone call that I get. So I give the first probably 12-14 months just learning, and building relationships in the council and figuring out who do I go to with this problem and that.
Yeah,
it's full on, like, it really.
So you're still there though. You're still learning the way and getting there, which is brilliant. And that's a new phase now, I suppose, in your life. Where are you with the cycling now at the moment? Like, the pandemic has affected it in a big way, I presume.
Yeah, I actually stepped away just not long after Christmas there. I suppose, like I was saying, it was always my plan. I was retiring after Tokyo. And I suppose the reality is Tokyo was supposed to be in 2020. But I was just struggling between trying to juggle. Like, I found myself in a scenario now where I have two vocations. Like, cycling was, I was probably doing 20 hours a week on the bike. And that's not the life I was living around it. And it's not including. And it was also taking me out of the country for about 12 weeks of the year. And I just couldn't stay justifying going away on the training camps and trying to be good at the politics. And I was just I actually got to a place where I probably felt like I was failing in both worlds. And I was like, do you know what? Like, I was supposed to be gone from, like, I had decided that in 2019, I was finding it tougher and tougher to be professional and to be, you know, I loved the cycling, but I was kind of outgrown. I wanted to do other things. I wanted to, like, that. I kind of know who I am. I know who I wasn't. And I wanted to do other, it was a hard decision, and I didn't realize how hard it was going to be until, I suppose, maybe a month in or whatever. But I'm glad I did it, as weird as that sounds. I'm sure I'll probably be crying looking at the telly when it's on, but sport hasn't left me, like, do you know what I mean? I'm still running, I'm still on a bike, I'm still, like, I've aims to do a few triathlons this year, and it's just part of who I am now, and being fit and healthy. I just use it kind of for my headspace, and I couldn't juggle it with the two any longer, really. I suppose that's the honest synopsis.
Yeah. Haven't you come some distance, Peter, really, where you've, you know, become a politician, had all this experience of, you know, good and bad things behind you now, like, you know, it's exciting. I'm kind of excited to see where you're going to go in the next few years, or what your plans are, or where life will lead you.
Well, that's it. And I actually, that's kind of how I try to live it. Do you know what I mean? And I don't always have a grand plan, but I do things that excite me. I do things, you know, when it's making sense. And if I'm not harming anyone else, then yeah, why not? Like, I think, like I say, like I do the work in with companies and coaching people and stuff like that. And you just realize how many people are just like, they're operating out of fear. And that can be, look at it, it can be positive and negative, but like, I just want to, like I said, I've had a really good experience of what bad looks like, and I have zero interest in going back to bad, and I'm just going to try and keep life exciting, stay having fun, try to be nice to people on the way, do a little bit of good, and, do you know what I mean, enjoy myself. And that's fairly well, and where it'll go, who knows, Steve? We could be talking in 10 years time, it could have all collapsed, but for the time being, like, I'm enjoying it, so yeah, I can't complain.
Oh, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Peter. Absolutely brilliant. Your third song choice, what's it going to be?
Yeah, my third song choice is Corner Shop, Brimful of Ashes. So I was trying to think of songs from different phases of my life, and it could have been the first album I bought, it could have been anything. But like, as I was saying at the start of this, like, from a family of nine, most of the family, there's five members older than me or whatever, so like, it would have been their music playing in the kitchen or whatever. I have four sisters that are older than me, so like, it was either Tracy Chapman or Travis. And anyways, I went with that one. I just kind of, it's one of those songs that reminds me of just being a young lad, and it was playing in the kitchen quite a bit. And yeah, so we'll go with that. And it's a bit more boppy than some of the other ones, so I don't want to bum anyone out here. So yeah,
music is huge, I suppose, in everyone's life, and it's something that can help people in a big way.
Like there's so many songs, like I said, whether it's taking me back to the first time I went to Hayes's and the excitement of that, or like, I have all these random, I could have went in so many different directions with these songs, but they were too internal. They were just little stories about me, and I kind of wanted to make them more about, like, just people in my life or just moments like that. So we could have another conversation all about this kind of stuff, Stevie. We might do when we turn off the recorder.
Great stuff, Peter Ryan. Here it is, Brimful of Ashes. Thanks for joining us today, Peter.
Nice one. Cheers.
sim. Behind movie scenes, behind the movie scenes. Sai Rani, she's the one that keeps the dream alive. From the morning past the evening to the end of the life. Brim full of Asher on the 45. Well, it's a brim full of Asher on the 45. Brim full of Asher on the 45. Well, it's a brim full. You're on the 45. And singing, illuminating.